Lecture 16, The Living Voice.
In reviewing and summing up and evaluating the Platonic dialogues, the most difficult problem is the problem of Socrates. Most of the great philosophers in the Western tradition have had to grapple with this problem because Socrates is the kind of fountainhead, the hero of Western speculation, the authoritative voice of reason, which tells us inquire and think and use your head. And yet, what lies behind the mask? What kind of a man is Socrates? What shall we think of this demonic hero of love and hero of knowledge? What are we to make of this after looking at all the dialogues? And unlike Plato, which is relatively straightforward, it's not so hard to get a grasp on Plato, distinguishing the construction Socrates or the historical Socrates from what we find in the dialogues is very difficult. So I'm not even going to try it. I'm going to say, on the basis of the dialogues, what can we say about Socrates? What have we found out? Well, Socrates is interested in the problem of identity, and we're interested in the problem of his identity. Who is Socrates? At the beginning of the Gorgias and at the beginning of the Protagoras, when Socrates grapples with these great sophists, he has himself or his student ask Gorgias and Protagoras, who are you? And what he's asking then is, what is your function? What do you do in society? What is your particular purpose in life? And it's not clear what Socrates' purpose is. He talks in the Apology, he talks of himself as being a gadfly and as driving the somnolent people towards virtue by impressing upon them the limits of and the extent of their own ignorance. But in fact, it's got to be more than that, because the difficulty with Socrates lies in the fact that he wears so many masks. How do we distinguish between the persona of Socrates and the man himself? Very, very difficult. Certainly as an object within the dialogues, as a new kind of hero, he is the universal hero of this universal kind of poetry. The lyrical lover of souls as opposed to bodies. He's the ideal lover. And he's the demon of love. He's the eudaimon, the eudaimonia of Athens. In other words, he is the happiness and the spirit of love within Athens. As an epic hero, he's the new hero of knowledge. He's on the spiritual journey. That's all true. He's a kind of an epic figure, a larger-than-life creature. He's the new tragic hero without the tragic flaw. He's in particular, though, and I would emphasize this, he's the new hero of humor. Socrates is a great comic hero. But there's a big difference in the kind of comedy we get in Socrates. Here we have not a human comedy, as we saw in Aristophanes. What we get in Socrates and in the Platonic dialogues as they represent Socrates is a divine comedy, a comedy which offers us a glimpse at something more, something higher. Instead of a comedy which points at human foibles, human depravity, it points beyond them towards something else. And this divine comedy that Socrates offers us means that he's a new and improved comic hero. And what will be connected with this is the fact that the dialogues are full of jokes, but the jokes are on the people that Socrates talks to. Socrates doesn't get fooled in the dialogues. No, Socrates is a sort of universal straight man. The joke is on everybody else. Note that in the dialogues, Socrates only laughs once over many hundreds of pages, talking to many different kinds of people, making all kinds of dramatic and symbolic and logical jokes. Socrates only laughs once. He's making jokes all the time, and other people laugh every once in a while, but the joke is inevitably on them. Socrates is one of the wittiest and most humorous of men, which is a very surprising characteristic in one of the great philosophical heroes of the Western tradition. He is living in his own comedy, but he's a straight man. The joke is on the people he talks to, and when we read the dialogues, the joke is on us. We should not make the mistake of thinking that because Socrates is making jokes, that he is lacking in moral seriousness. And we should also not make the mistake of thinking that Socrates is laughing at us merely with the intention of ridiculing us. All of the dialogues, all of art, all of Socrates' activities are intended to be educational, and we are supposed to get from Socrates a kind of moral education. That is what he is trying to show us. Kierkegaard, one of my favorite philosophers, was also a great admirer of Socrates. He wrote his doctoral dissertation on Socratic irony, and he was particularly interested in irony himself, and he's particularly interested in the state of the soul. And he made a very interesting observation about Socrates once. He said that all melancholic men have the best senses of humor, that the funniest men are almost inevitably melancholy, and that one serves as a mask for the other. And I strongly suspect that that's the case, at least when we consider Socrates. That is to say, Kierkegaard himself was quite ironic and had a wonderful sense of humor and was a decisively melancholy individual. And the fact that he should recognize that in Socrates suggests to me that Socrates was a highly melancholic individual. At least this is my Socrates. Reading it now again, you know, in the middle part of my life, I can't help but believe that behind this persistent good humor, this persistent drive towards improving himself and improving others, there is a dark side here. No, perhaps it's true of all comedians, but the greatest of the comic heroes, Socrates, I think, has a persistent streak of melancholy. Kierkegaard, who knows himself and who knows irony and who has a wonderful sense of humor, perhaps senses a kindred spirit here. It also appears to me that Gorgias, remember when we talked about him during the dialogue by the same name, that Gorgias has a certain streak of melancholy, and that is what drives him to the extreme of sophistry in the same way that Socrates is driven towards the extreme of philosophy, both being pursued by the demons of unhappiness. Both afraid, or if not afraid, both being pushed along towards their extreme path because nothing in this world is completely satisfactory to them. As Alcibiades says of Socrates at the end of the Symposium, he does not love the way we love. He does not love the things that we love. If you think about the encomium on Socrates at the end of the Symposium, Alcibiades says, he's not interested in sex the way we are. He's not interested in money. Look, he's never made any money. He's the smartest guy in Athens. At a time when Alcibiades was with him on a military campaign, Socrates showed great bravery and took care of Alcibiades, but then was disdainful of military decorations and give them to Alcibiades. He would really like them. The idea is that Socrates cannot find in this world of space and time, in the things that most men pursue most of the time, does not find anything that satisfies him or gratifies him or makes him feel that this is worthy of him. Socrates' entire thought and his entire drive is towards something else, something higher, something superior. Remember that at the end, in the Phaedo, when Socrates is dying, he says, I expect two things to happen. One, I'm sure that I'm going to the gods, which is where he's perhaps always belonged. And two, with any luck, I will find up there good and virtuous men and women that have lived lives down here that were praiseworthy and that were divine, and then I'll be able to talk to them. And what will be most entertaining about heaven is that I'll meet more people that are more interesting to talk to than the people I met down here. You might almost think it was a bitter irony, but Socrates has no bitterness. What he is saying is that this world has been a great disappointment to him. And the people around him, he did his best with them, but they have disappointed him. And he doesn't hold that against him. He knows that all wrongdoing is involuntary. He knows that they don't mean to be ignorant or mean-spirited or cruel, but they are not what they could be. And the world around us is imperfect, is not what it could be. And it makes him long for a permanence and an excellence and a virtue that he does not find down here in the world of space and time. He is the true daemon of love. But this daemon has one foot in the world of space and time and one foot in the beyond somehow. And all his jokes seem to suggest that he is comparing the true world of unchanging reality, of perfect formality, with this world down here, and this world has been judged and found lacking. Many of his jokes suggest that he's in on the joke of the gods and that he realizes that the things that we pursue, that the things we take seriously, are not to be taken seriously. He wants to move us away from our pursuit of wealth or pleasure or power towards the pursuit of something divine. In some ways, Socrates is a joke played upon us by the gods. He has been sent down here, who clearly does not belong here, and that is why Socrates is always making jokes, jokes that we don't understand, jokes that the interlocutors don't understand. Whenever Socrates' interlocutors laugh, they're always laughing at their own jokes or at something that seems foolish, but in fact, the times when they laugh are almost always inappropriate. In fact, Socrates is being serious and people laugh at him, and then when he's being kind of jocular, when he's joking with people, people would take it with grim seriousness. This irony allows him to conceal his own superiority. In other words, irony, which is a kind of dissembling, which is very similar, perhaps the first cousin of telling a lie, right, really isn't a lie. It's a sort of deceptive gesture which keeps people from realizing how superior a man he is. And I suppose irony in this sense is a sort of mechanism of self-preservation. The people around him are unworthy of Socrates, and it's not just true of the people that lived in the same space and time with Socrates. After reading the dialogues, it's hard to come away with the feeling that we are worthy of him. It is hard to think that we can live up to these high ideals. In that respect, by showing us our ineptitude, our viciousness, our incompleteness, he is playing a joke on us, saying, you came here looking for wisdom, and in fact, the only wisdom I can give you is that you have a lot longer to go. You have a long way to go. That's the best thing I could tell you. Socrates has hidden himself. Socrates, like God, is mysterious and enigmatic. And he seems to be playing some sort of joke with us based upon the idea that he has seen both realms and we are poor creatures of space and time. Perhaps that would make anyone melancholic. The longing for home, the longing for permanence, the longing for heaven, which all of us have some doubts about. Perhaps the internal jokes, the internal humor, what is hidden behind the mask is something angelic and divine. Well, Socrates has played his little game of irony and has been laughing up his sleeve all his career, as Alcibiades says. And Alcibiades, having taken on the voice of the god, we are assured is telling us the truth. And I'm fairly confident that if Socrates had not been ironic, he would have been killed much earlier in his career. Suppose Socrates had said directly to the people of Athens, you're vicious and ignorant, and you should let me run the state immediately, and had completely refrained from hiding behind this ironic mask and from only talking to a few people. Suppose he had said, you're vicious and corrupt, and you deserve to lose the Peloponnesian War because you can't control yourselves, much less other people. You deserve these political catastrophes. Well, I think that he would have been killed as a treasonable, as an evil man, as a man who is in conflict with the good of the people around him. And of course, he would have been even more completely misunderstood then. So perhaps the irony here is the fact that instead of hiding himself or concealing himself, in his irony, Socrates reveals as much of himself as we can possibly absorb. But there's no excess. And you become spiritually or mentally prepared for reading the dialogues as you purify yourself, as you move from a state of ignorance to a state of knowledge, as you read them several times, as you start to compare them across space and time, across the different parts of the dialogues, what you begin to get is a sort of spiritual journey of your own. You follow the path of Socrates from one idea to another, and then the irony begins to strip away. You never, I think, completely get rid of the layers of irony. It's like an onion that has many layers to it. But as you study them and as you prepare your own soul, as you absorb the Socratic knowledge, the ironies, at least the immediate, apparent surface ironies, begin to disappear. But I think the ironies never disappear completely. The final irony is that the irony only conceals as much as you conceal from yourself. Right? It is a test of the soul. It is a mirror of the soul. Remember the Phaedrus, that good and loving rhetoric which tries to improve the beloved, constructs the identity and shows you who you are? I think that every person projects himself or herself into the Socratic dialogues. When you read them, you cannot but push your own agenda, your own sets of thoughts in there. Look at the great philosophers and what they have done, the tremendously disparate interpretations we have gotten of Socrates. Think of Nietzsche's spiteful and evil interpretation of Socrates. There's clearly a tremendous amount of envy here in Nietzsche's interpretation of Socrates' death scene. Think of Kierkegaard. His own melancholia comes out, and he recognizes it in Socrates. And they are, in some ways, talking about different men because different parts of the mask have been taken off, depending on what you can bring to the dialogues. The dialogues are a test of your own spiritual resources. And as they increase, the amount of irony decreases, but perhaps the irony is infinite. So no matter how many ironic masks you remove, there's still a mask underneath. Socrates, then, is a standing challenge and a standing joke because he is the greatest of comic heroes. It's a joke that's too deep for us to plumb. We can't get to the bottom of this divine comedy. And Socrates tells us that much, that in so many words, in more than one occasion. The telos of his irony, the purpose of his irony, because remember that he's interested in teleology, he's interested in purpose of activity and purposive accounts of the external world. The telos of irony is education. And he educates us with this irony because irony is a provocation. He points us in the right direction by making us feel foolish and stupid. I ought to be able to understand this book. I've been reading it for many years now, and alas, I do not. It also is a temptation. He says, I dare you to come and understand this. I dare you to get underneath my final mask. These ironies are intended to push us along, to goad us towards a deeper and richer and finer reading of the dialogues, which involves improving ourselves and increasing the stock of intellectual and spiritual resources we bring to the dialogues. What do we find out at the end? We find out how ignorant we are, how extensive the domain of our foolishness and vice is. And what that does for us is increase our consciousness. It increases our self-knowledge. As the Oracle at Delphi says, know thyself. Socrates is the man who is particularly good at knowing himself, and the process by which his self-knowledge is extended to other people so that they might know themselves is continued not just in Socrates' lifetime, but throughout the history of the dialogues. When we read the dialogues, we find out about Socrates, and Socrates offers us a chance to look at ourselves, to introspect and examine our own souls. And what do we find in our own souls? Viciousness, ignorance, insufficient and unsatisfactory spiritual resources. All this is protreptic. It is an exhortation, pushing us on the journey of the dialectic. We too must become new heroes of soul, new heroes of mind. Socrates offers us a heroism that we can emulate because we are ignorant, vicious, foolish people who are best off if we stop fooling ourselves. Knowledge, like charity, begins at home, begins within the soul. And if we're going to be nice to other people, we might just as well be nice to ourselves. Stop fooling ourselves. Stop kidding ourselves. Stop relaxing in intellectual slackness and intellectual vice. The point of Socrates is not the eternal questions, what is reality, what is being, that's foolishness, or the eternal answers. Nothing is more unsocratic than the idea of eternal answers. No, there's just the provisional answer that we'll accept for now, and if it turns out that we change our minds later for some good reason, that is the most Socratic thing, not being caught in this ossified dogma. If the theory of forms turns out to be unsatisfactory, the most Socratic thing in the world is to get rid of it. It would be easy to draw the wrong inference from what I said about Plato's doubts about the theory of forms later on in his career. Socrates perhaps gave up the theory of forms or perhaps never even had the theory of forms. Who knows and who cares? Socrates is not the purveyor of a set of dogmas, a finished set of conclusions. He is showing us how to ask questions of other people and also of ourselves. And we must be sure that as we ask these questions, as we embark upon this Pythagorean spiritual journey, as we follow in the footsteps of Socrates insofar as we can, we not be overtaken with the solemnity of the occasion. We should not get the misapprehension that we are really important and that we are really significant. In fact, self-importance is the opposite of Socratic self-understanding. In fact, your importance lies in the fact that you are on the spiritual journey, and it's not the destination, it's the process of getting where you're going. The gods love a joke, and Socrates is a joke that has been played upon us by the gods. Perhaps this whole human world, this all of human life, is that kind of a joke. And there's a wonderful passage in the Cratylus, a dialogue that I didn't do, that exemplifies this in a beautiful way. I want to read it to you because it is very funny. And you could easily pass over this and not understand that this is intended as a joke. This is a Cratylus, section 406b. His interlocutor asks, what is the meaning of Dionysus and Aphrodite? Now remember what the symbolism is here. Dionysus, drunkenness, excess, art, emotion, and Aphrodite, the human sex drive. So in other words, what is the significance of our emotions? In other words, asking the great sage, what does our bronze part, the part which dominates in almost all of us almost all the time, what does it mean, Socrates? And Socrates says, son of Hipponicus, you ask a solemn question. There is a serious and also a facetious explanation for both of these names. The serious explanation is not to be had from me, but there is no objection to your hearing a facetious one, for the gods too love a joke. The disorganized state of our emotional life, the fact that we are not in control of Dionysus and Aphrodite, is a joke played upon us by the gods. And to think that there is some solemn answer that we can get from Socrates about these things is a joke we play on ourselves. In fact, Socrates says, look, a facetious answer is not no answer. And even though we don't achieve any final wisdom in the Socratic dialogues, he teaches us that we should not take ourselves or this project too seriously. And if the project of self-knowledge, if the project of the Socratic dialectic is not a thing to be taken seriously, surely things like political power and wealth and pleasure are even less noble, even less worthy. And certainly the people that take them seriously are the ones who are even worse off than the ones who take knowledge seriously. There perhaps is nothing in human life which we should take with grim seriousness. Only God, only the divinity is truly serious. So if you are caught up in some kind of jumble, if you are in an emotional tangle, if you are in an emotional or a personal tangle with other people, be quiet, relax, and reflect. You may think that you are in a jam. You may think that all these things are important. This is the world of illusion. And the biggest illusion that we carry with us is the fact that we are important and all the projects we have decided to engage in are important. Relax, step back, take a deep breath, and inquire into yourself. Pursue your own knowledge of yourself. It is far more important than anything you will get from the external world. This is an important part of the Socratic legacy. Now, jokes like this are extremely serious. Socrates is a serious joke. Again, do not make the mistake of thinking that playfulness and seriousness are incompatible. Alas, they are not. He has been playing jokes on us all through, and he's just pointing out to us that we have been playing jokes on ourselves. And perhaps we will finally achieve a sort of Socratic sense of humor when we start to play jokes not on ourselves, but on other people. The kind of beneficial, morally improving jokes that are involved in teaching other people what they are and in showing other people how, if not to gain virtue, how to move towards virtue, how to open their mind and liberate their souls. Now, how do we get down to the bottom of this? Is there any bottom of this, or is this just an infinite regress of larger and larger and more profound philosophical jokes? And I think that, I don't know if we can get to the bottom, but we can move asymptotically towards it. The jokes in the dialogues tease us. They say, look, you're foolish enough to have taken this seriously the last time you read it, but now you underline it in a different color because you realize that this is ironic rather than true. The irony, the flip-flop between stating something and stating the opposite, teases us, provokes us because of the threat it has, it offers us to our self-conception, to our understanding of ourselves as being vessels of self-contained wisdom. He punctures those vessels and says, look, you aren't even close to what you think you are. Your self-conception is flawed. And this forces us, this enigmatic kind of irony, forces us to ask defensive questions of the dialogues. And what's most remarkable and miraculous about these dialogues is that when we ask them the right questions, they answer. The dialogues speak to us. The dialogues are a mimesis, a representation of the living voice. That's what's immortal about Socrates and immortal about the dialogues. They represent the immediate articulation of persistent human problems, persistent human questions. And that's why they never get out of style. The questions may change, but the changes are minor compared to the fact that the idea of questioning at all, the idea of pursuing knowledge of yourself and, by implication, knowledge of other people, that's what's permanent in Socrates. He is the image of the inquirer. Now, I don't know what the final joke of the dialogues is, but let me give you a shot at it, or do the best I can with it, at the risk of making myself kind of foolish, at the risk of making a joke of myself. I think the biggest joke in the dialogues is that they don't teach you anything. I read this big fat book many times. Some of these dialogues I've read 30, 40, 50 times, something like The Republic. And at the end of all this reading, I spent years reading this stuff, you don't learn anything. It is arguably the most profound philosophy ever constructed. It is arguably the deepest and most enigmatic set of poetic, logical images brought together in one unique kind of an art form. And after reading it, what do you find out? Keep thinking. Keep thinking, and it's like a carrot and stick. You take another step along the road of dialectic, and do you get the carrot? You never get the carrot. You never get to the form of knowledge, the form of the good. Think about Glaucon climbing up out of the cave with Socrates and says, Socrates, what is the form of the good? And Socrates says, sorry, this is where the journey of dialectic ends. Now you've got to take it on your own, kid. What? In some ways, it's a real sad irony, but on the other hand, perhaps he's just saying that language is asymptotic. Human life never achieves the divine. It is outside our capacities altogether. There is, strictly speaking, no Socratic dogma. There is no set of conclusions that allows you to be a Socratic. If you look at the whole history of the criticism of the Socratic dialogues, the philosophers project a great deal more of themselves into their interpretation of this than they pull out. If you were from a completely alien culture, from Mars, for example, and came down and looked at the various interpretations of Socrates throughout the 25-century history since Socrates was alive, you would almost guess that they were different people. Nietzsche's interpretation has nothing to do with the interpretations offered by the Neoplatonists. And the Neoplatonist conception of Socrates is very different from that of Kierkegaard. We only get out of the dialogues what we bring in. And that, in some ways, is a standing joke played on us. It is a huge practical joke, but it is also an intellectual joke, and it is a joke, strangely enough, which benefits us. Socrates, then, is the greatest of the philosophical jokers. I would say that the Platonic dialogues are one huge comedy, a human comedy which gestures at the divine, but never brings us to it. It's like Moses, who can see the promised land, but never actually gets to enter it. He gives us some vague and fuzzy conception of what real divine final knowledge would be like, but the joke is on us. We shall not reach it. We can only move in the direction of it. Even more ironic, and perhaps even more comic in a kind of deep and philosophical sense, is that not only is there no Socratic dogmas, but there is no Socratic book. Socrates, like all the great spiritual teachers of mankind, never wrote a book. The Buddha never wrote a book. Confucius never wrote a book. Any of the great spiritual teachers were beyond writing. Right? If you look at any of the great spiritual teachers of mankind, they did not want to fix their thought in a book. In the Phaedrus, specifically, when Socrates talks about rhetoric, he says explicitly, I don't trust the written word. Only the living word really does the job, because you can't ask questions of a book. Plato can't talk directly back to us. The best we can do is reconstruct what he might or might not have meant, what he might or might not have thought, based upon these dead words. And that is one reason why the Platonic dialogues are an elaborate joke played upon us. Socrates never wrote a book, and after reading hundreds or even thousands of pages of Socratic dialogue, you don't know what Socrates thinks, and you don't know what sense ultimately to make out of this. Socrates is a persistent enigma, a joke played on us. He's the universal straight man. He's a superior kind of comic hero where we're the ridiculous, foolish people. And what is ridiculous and foolish about us, I think he talks about this in the Philebus, one of the later dialogues where he talks about pleasure. He says that comedy involves people that don't know themselves, foolish, ridiculous people that, because of their lack of self-knowledge and their lack of self-understanding, make the kind of mistakes that are human, all too human. What we find is that the Socratic dialogues point away from themselves. They don't point towards the external world. They don't point towards space and time. They don't point towards the gratification of our senses or our desires. What they point towards is the living voice. Socrates is the image of our desire for communication. Socrates is the great icon, the great hero of connection, social, loving connection to other people. And we cannot make that connection with other people by reading great books of philosophy. Socrates himself didn't write any books. No, Socrates is using his dialogic method to push us towards communication, because it's this communication, this connection with other people, that refines us, that improves us, and if it does not perfect us, it is not the fault of the dialogue. It is not the fault of the living voice. The fault is our own. You might want to say that Socrates is the Word made flesh. He is the image of the divinity. And this divinity somehow is what connects these individual little egos that we are, trapped in these individual little bodies that we are. He shows us how to be something bigger, more permanent, more divine, and more perfect than we are. So, what's the joke here? Well, there are many layers to the joke. First joke is that this is not Socrates. This is a mimesis, a representation of Socrates made by Plato. Socrates himself didn't believe in the written word. And Plato also says that he doesn't believe in the written word, oddly enough. He says, the best I could do to be true to the memory and to the spirit of Socrates is to write the Socratic dialogues. But in the seventh letter, one of Plato's personal writings, he says explicitly that I have never written any Socratic dogmas down, or I've never written the real doctrine down. You can't write the real doctrine down. In other words, this is just a representation, like a photograph or a painting of an activity. It is not the activity itself. Do not make the mistake of thinking that Platonism or Socratic philosophy is to be found in this book. This is just a gesture at that Socratic life, and that Socratic life is bound up with the living word. You cannot learn, ironically enough, you cannot learn Socratic philosophy from Plato. You can't learn anything from a book. You learn by inquiring, by taking part in a living encounter with your own perplexity. And what this necessarily forces you to do is to become a social animal, to make a bridge towards other people. This is why the Phaedrus and the Symposium are so important. It is the living word, this drive towards communication, that makes us fully human, that pulls us out of the miserable, wretched shoals of our own egoism. It allows us to embark on an ocean of speech. And this ocean of speech is where we really belong. We can't completely navigate it. We will never complete our journey. Socrates never got final wisdom. He couldn't tell us what the realm of the forms is. But the journey itself is what makes our life blessed and worthwhile. The irony, then, is that you can't learn Socratic philosophy through this mimesis. The best we can do is treat this as an exhortation towards living the examined life, towards facing squarely our ignorance and our depravity and doing whatever we can to force ourselves towards some higher, finer, better state. Now there's another joke, doesn't come from Plato or from Socrates, connected with all this. And this is me. This is my joke. And alas, the joke is here, and I haven't been able to get around it. I would if I could. I would give you serious lectures if I could, but I don't know how. And here's the problem. Back at home, wherever you are, you are either listening to this on audio tape or you are watching this on television. And I am not a set of dots on your television screen. I am not this array of lights. I am not these sounds coming out of your stereo speakers. In fact, I'm a person somewhere else. What you have in front of you with these audio tapes or with these videotapes is a representation. It is a mimesis. And that means that I am rather far down on the divided line with all the other images and shadows and poetic constructs. You thought that I was going to teach you Socrates and Plato. You thought that you were going to find out about this stuff from me. Well, I have a joke for you. First of all, there's nothing to find out. And second of all, even if there were something to find out, I couldn't tell it to you. The best I can do is what Plato did, is to construct a representation of Plato's representation of Socrates doing what Socrates did. So in other words, if there were another notch on the divided line below the poets, below Platonic art, well, I would be down there. All right? So first of all, do not mistake this array of dots on your television screen for being Mike Segrue. I'm not an array of dots. Take my word for it. Not only that, do not mistake my lectures for Platonism. They're not. Platonism is to be found in the book. If you want to know about Plato, read his book. There is no substitute for that. In other words, there's no royal road to knowledge. Much as I like the idea of giving lectures on audio and videotape, there is no way to get around the fact that you must do your reading. You will never know this stuff. You will never taste these wonderful experiences if you are not willing to look at the book itself. You must apply yourself. You must pay your dues. I've paid my dues. I've read the book, and I've found something that gives me the highest and finest incentive towards an examined life. You must do the same. I cannot do this for you. The joke goes further. Once you've done that and paid your dues and spent many hours and hopefully many pleasant hours reading the Socratic dialogues, reading what Plato has to say about his master Socrates and also about the other interlocutors that he has, even then, all you have is a poetic mimesis, the bottom of the divided line. So I'm going to try and help you or exhort you or explain to you how to climb the ladder of beauty. Remember in the symposium, we move from the beauty of physical objects, the beauty of bodies, to the beauty of thoughts, to the beauty of souls, and then from there to the beauty of the forms themselves. The best I can do is to exhort you, to tell you to climb that ladder, but I cannot climb the ladder for you. The best that we can do then, ironically, with this collection of philosophical jokes, is for me to give you some things to think about, some things to work over in your brain as you read the dialogues, or before you read the dialogues, or after you read the dialogues. And each of these speeches, each of these lectures, and each of these dialogues is a step on that journey of dialectic towards self-knowledge. But alas, do not mistake the shadow for the thing. Do not mistake these sounds coming out of your stereo speakers for a lecture on Plato. In fact, it's a representation of a lecture, and my lecture is a representation of Plato's dialogues, and the dialogues are a representation of Socrates. Socrates is a long way off. You cannot become a new Socrates. We cannot live the life of the which imitates Socrates in the same way that perhaps Christians wish to imitate Christ or Buddhists wish to imitate the Buddha. Socrates is a peculiar thing. He has the daimon in his brain. He is obviously a divine creature of a very unique cast. The best we can do is to approximate the Socratic path and move on it as far as we possibly can. The path is endless, but the point is not the destination, but the journey. What is good for our souls, what will refine us and humanize us, make us better than we are, if not perfect, is the willingness to exert yourself in engaging the living human voice. So to finish off these set of ironies, this lack of my lack of ability to show you what Socrates really means, my point is this. These lectures will probably do you some good, give you something to think about and allow you to look at some themes that you may not have seen in your first reading of the dialogues. God knows I've read them many times. After you go to the dialogues, you read them, you think them over, but your project doesn't end there. Socrates shows us that you cannot study philosophy without your friends. You must have philosophical friends. You cannot be a hermit. You cannot simply go to a cave with the Platonic dialogues and live the Socratic life. If you could do that, Socrates would have done it. He would have gone to some mountaintop. He stayed in the city. He was a creature of the polis, because it's only in the city among living human beings that Socrates could find the living voice. What Socrates offers to us is the chance to get out beyond the limits of our ego, to participate in something larger, the logos. And you can't participate in the logos, which means both speech and reason and argument, by yourself. You cannot talk to yourself. You cannot simply listen to the mimesis of me on your stereo or on your TV and think that you can have a dialogue with me. I can't answer your questions. I would if I could, but I cannot. So this mimesis is a protreptic. We're trying to push you towards the dialogues, and the dialogues are trying to push you towards Socrates, and Socrates is trying to push you towards the living voice. Become human. Allow your mind to inquire into all things, and do not think it impious if you reach different conclusions from Socrates. That is not the overthrow of Socratic philosophy, that is the culmination of Socratic philosophy. If it turns out that you don't like Plato's theory of forms, get rid of it. Plato isn't worried and neither is Socrates. If it turns out you don't like Plato's conception of nature, get rid of it. Talk the problem out with your philosophical friends. Come up with a better, higher, finer idea, and that is the culmination of Socratic philosophy. That does not undermine Socratic philosophy. It's because of the fact that Socrates represents the living voice, that Socrates will never be superseded. And the best a teacher can do is to drive you towards the dialogues. The best the dialogues can do is to drive you towards the human voice. And the best the human voice can do is to drive you towards knowledge of yourself by creating self-knowledge in other people. And we only do this linguistically, as Socrates showed us in Phaedrus. The self is constructed in language, in the loving struggle to create intelligibility, to create order, to create a construction of the soul in which all the parts are doing what they ought to do. This goes back to teleological explanation. Think about what the parts of you are, how your desire relates to your reason, how the better part of your nature should take control of the worse, the ungainly, the disorganized. Socrates offers us the drive to perfection. And this drive to perfection is a loving, wonderful, serious struggle, but this seriousness never degenerates into self into self-importance. It is a solemnity which is joyous rather than lugubrious. Socrates points out in the Laws, what's the section? I'll read it to you, that if we are really going to follow the Socratic life, we have to realize that this veil of Maya around us is none too important, and we have no choice but to live in it. But the best we can do is to organize our soul in relation to it. And once we organize our chaos within, we can begin to organize the chaos without. I will leave you on the following thought, which is taken from the Laws, section 803b. It's a kind of parting shot from Socrates, which shows the combination of seriousness and comedy, which is characteristic of the dialogues, this resolution of opposites. The anonymous Athenian, the Athenian stranger of the Laws, says, "To be sure, man's life is a business which does not deserve to be taken too seriously. Yet we cannot help being in earnest about it, and there's the pity. Why, I mean, we should keep our seriousness for serious things and not waste it on trifles, and that while God is the real goal of all beneficent, serious endeavor, man, as we said before, has been constructed as a toy for God, and this is, in fact, the finest thing about him. All of us, then, men and women alike, must fall in with our role and spend life in making our play as perfect as possible. Go play with the dialogues. This is the best advice I can give you. Thank you."
I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. We hope you've enjoyed the lectures on these tapes. To order more courses or to receive a copy of our most recent catalog, call 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12. Or visit us on the internet at www.teachco.com. That's teachco.com.